Thank you, Carenza. 8:07, I have a very, very special guest in my studio here today. Kin Thi Vu is here. And Kin Thi Vu is a lecturer, Department of Music Education at Boston University. And I've known Kin Thi Vu for some time now, and so have you. You may have remembered him as Joe Palmateer, the excellent band director at Killingly High School from 2005 to 2010. He actually appeared on my show several times with, what was her name there from Killingly High School? Who's that other one in the music department?
Who does? I think her name is Pam Rogers.
Oh, that's right. Pam Rogers, too. Yes, she may have stopped by a couple times as well. It's funny. You get to know someone, and I thought I knew you, Joe. I'm just like, okay, yeah, that's Joe, man. He's the band director. He's a cool guy. KHS. He moved on, did some other things. I heard, you got your doctorate and continued your education. You're doing great things at Boston University. But then recently, I heard this story from friends and mutual acquaintances that you have an extraordinary story about the beginning of your life. And I said, oh, my God, I would love to have Vu come in and chat with us, particularly at this time. You're hearing about this now. You'll be hearing a lot more about it in the week or so to come. We're in the 40th anniversary here of the fall of Saigon and the end of the Vietnam War and reunification for Vietnam and everything that came with that. 40 years. For most people, the iconic photograph is the evacuation helicopter on the roof of embassies or whatever, and people clamoring to get out. You were there. You're 40 years old, and this is the 40th anniversary. May we go back to the very, very beginnings in South Vietnam and Saigon?
Yeah, let's begin where the story that I've been told. Thanks, Gary, for having me here on the show. This is an important story, I think, that I shared only infrequently with my students and my colleagues. I was born sometime in 1974 in Saigon, which is now Ho Chi Minh City in the south of Vietnam. And I was left, what I thought the story was, I had been left on the embassy steps. That is not true. I found out very recently, about a year ago, that I was left at an orphanage gate somewhere in the center of this bustling city in a basket with some clothes and left to be saved by some nuns or some orphanage workers. And recently found that place in Ho Chi Minh City, I would say back in April, a year ago. And wow, what a powerful place that was. I felt connected to it. I was taken in 40 years ago by some very kind women at the orphanage. And one woman by the name of Betty Tisdale, who at the time was employed by Senator Jacob Javits of New York, she was volunteering in Vietnam from the 1960s through the 1970s and learned that Saigon was going to fall to the north. And she organized an evacuation of 219 children to leave Saigon and come to the United States sometime at the end of the war. It turned out to be April 10th when I was airlifted to the United States, arrived here in Los Angeles April 12th of 1975, and was admitted to UCLA Children's Hospital, where I was treated for sickness for a few months and then adopted in central Pennsylvania by an American family.
You said you visited that orphanage is still there as an orphanage?
It is not an orphanage any longer. It is now a rest home for communist workers.
Okay. So you were there. You were there for the during the fall. President Ford, early in April, started Operation Baby Lift to go along with the impending evacuation of all Americans and many South Vietnamese as well. Operation Baby Lift was kind of focused on this. And again, Betty Tisdale at this particular orphanage, On Lock, is that how you say that? Which means happy place.
Wow, you've done your homework.
Indeed. So 219, I guess you were among the last of the Operation Baby Lift to make it out. So you make your way here. They put you in a cardboard box on a plane.
Yeah, pretty impressive.
And off we go. Of the 219, Every single one was placed, I understand, was placed, adopted in a short period of time, within a month or so, every child was placed. Of the 219, the 20 who needed medical care the most, you were one of them, ended up at UCLA. Tell me about this doctor, the doctor who treated you back then, 40 years ago, and the reunion with this doctor.
Well, the reunion with Dr. Barry Halpern, a neonatologist, I believe that's what it is, was serendipitous. The spring of 2010 was my last semester at Killingly High School, and it was a busy, busy semester. I was applying for PhD programs. I was traveling to Los Angeles two or three times a month just to meet with this doctor. I had found his name on some paperwork that had been passed down to me by Trussler Lutheran Services, and I found this name of an intern named Barry Halpern, and it was a handwritten medical report from 1975, and I thought, well, this guy's probably still practicing medicine if he was an intern in 1975. So I looked him up using the internet and found that he is a doctor in Northridge, which is just outside Los Angeles, and I wrote him a letter from my office in Killingly High School, which was really a closet. I guess they have nicer offices now. I missed out on that part. Hope you enjoy that, Jeff.
Yep.
And,
pretty nice place now.
Well, I wrote him a letter from my office, and I sent it, dropped it in the mail. About 3 weeks later, I was visiting some friends in for a dinner party in Danielson, and I got a phone call from this guy, Barry Halpern, and we talked for 2 or 3 hours that evening. He invited me out to L.A. It was the same time that the Affordable Health Care Act was going through Congress, and California and Californians needed a good story about healthcare because this new law was about to affect the cost of healthcare in California. And so Barry invited me to come out to UCLA. He connected me with the media people at the Children's Hospital and at the Geffen School of Medicine. So I traveled out to LA to meet with some people, and there was a press conference, and it was really very interesting. It was odd being a music teacher and being followed by 20 or 30 media around UCLA campus, being treated like a rock star for a week. It was a lot of fun, but meeting this doctor was something. And in the letter that I had sent him in January of 2010, I said to him, you asked my family physician to get back to him about how I was doing as a baby. And I'm sure no one ever had gotten back to Barry. And so I wrote to him 35 years later. And
here's that update you were asking about.
Here's the update. This is what's going on. And it was really powerful.
Obviously, it must've been a very powerful reunion for both, for the both of you. When did you start exploring your roots to this extent, and why? And tell me about the name change also, please.
Yes. So, again, 2010, that spring, was such a turbulent and exciting time. I had excellent students. I had a fantastic student teacher at the time who was so helpful, Amanda Richmond, who teaches at Griswold. Go, Amanda. And these people made it possible for me to take some time to explore self and investigate my own story. And at the time, I didn't really know what the self story was or how to go about discovering who is me, who am I? And that ontological question of who am I, how do I know? The epistemological and the axiological questions of value, how do I value myself, are, or were, and still are, important. So I just thought the first step is I have to take back my Vietnamese name. I was never a Joe or a Joey.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that as a high schooler. I never went by that. People call me all kinds of things. They call me JR. They call me Seth. But they never called me Joe or Joey. It just didn't resonate with me. And it's interesting, Gary, this is the first time I've really talked about the name, the American name, which is a painful name to me.
Why?
It brings back memories. There's a pardon the expression, everyone, but it was taking away my Vietnamese name when I was adopted in 1975 is a form to me, a form of identity theft, a form of cultural rape. Culture, the Vietnamese culture, was never talked about. I have a feeling that 1975 and America's exit from Saigon was painful. It was painful for the veterans who people didn't look at them. Yeah. And it was a time when you forgot about it. Sweep it under the rug. It was a time when Nixon had just recently resigned office. Mm-hmm. Ford had taken office after Watergate. It was an unpopular war. Unpopular in Vietnam. Unpopular in the United States. Anyway, taking back my Vietnamese name was an important piece of taking back or beginning a journey of discovery of the self. And I'm so thankful to Pomfret Court of Probate Judge Leah Shad for looking at me and saying, well, of course, this is your name. And when I changed my name back to my Vietnamese name, she thought it was a no-brainer. So Leah Shad, if you're out there, thank you so much for listening to my story.
Mm-hmm. When obviously there'll be much reflection about Vietnam, the war, and everything that goes with it. Many of the things that you just mentioned as we lead up to the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And when you look back, I mean, you just mentioned a couple of things. What would your message be to Vietnam veterans? A veteran who is listening this morning, a Vietnam veteran. And I don't know what they're thinking when they think of I'm guessing it's not great feelings. I mean, most Americans, most people around the world aren't thinking good things when they think Vietnam War, the fall of Saigon. But then I look at you and what you've done, what you've accomplished, your outlook on life, you're the very definition of sanguine, if you will, and this is good right here. I'm looking at something very, very good.
There in 1960s and 1970s, I've seen photographs of Anlach Orphanage and American servicemen and women helping at the orphanage. Mm. I met an American soldier about 3 years ago when I first visited Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, in 2011. A guy by the name of Jim. He's from Oregon, I think, or Florida, I don't recall. But he was at Anlach Orphanage as a volunteer and an American serviceman. And we reunited in Ho Chi Minh City. I'm so thankful for our American servicemen and women who serve in foreign wars. They don't choose war. Mm-hmm. Our government chooses war and puts our people in the front line to fight wars that people on Capitol Hill will never see. I will never see it. And I'm so thankful that there are people who will fight with blood so that I can make art.
Right. That's exactly what's happening. We have a great guest here today. We're going to take a short break here and just regroup. It's Kin Thi Vu, again, lecturer, Department of Music Education, Boston University, and former educator here at Killingly High School. And he was part of Operation Baby Lift some 40 years ago in the lead up to the fall of Saigon. It's 8:21. Good morning. Continuing on for our next segment here and final segment with Dr. Kin Thi Vu, lecturer, Department of Music Education, Boston University, part of Operation Baby Lift 40 years ago during the fall of Saigon, a date that you have been hearing about and certainly will hear more about in the week to come. So we talked about the beginning, being left at the orphanage in a basket, the airlift here to the United States, your care for the first 2 months here in the United States, at the UCLA Medical Center. You were adopted and raised in what state?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. What kind of town were you raised? Was it a city or a small town?
Raised in a small town, something like Norwich.
Yeah. A lot of Vietnamese kids at school?
Not at all. No. There were hardly any Asians. As a matter of fact, I like telling this story. There were only two times when I saw any people of Asian heritage. Little League World Series and Regional Youth Orchestra.
Okay.
I found them. They were in the string section.
Yeah, that was excellent. What did you, at what age were you when you said, you know what, music education is what I want to do? How old were you when you figured that out?
I was probably a sophomore in college.
Yeah.
I started college as a religion and philosophy major and thought, this isn't for me, and I really like the music department, and I have some good memories from being a high school music student.
You went to college where?
I went to a small liberal arts college in western Pennsylvania called Westminster College, Presbyterian-affiliated school.
And a degree in?
Music education.
And then your master's. Tell me about your master's program.
Yeah, I taught for 6 years, and then I went to Penn State University for a master's degree in wind band conducting. Taught for 5 years in Killingly, and then went to the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul for my PhD in music education.
Okay, and now, what are you doing today? What's your job today?
Yeah, today I have a job working at Boston University on Commonwealth Avenue as a lecturer in music education. I teach graduate music education courses, foundations of music education, sociology, psychology, philosophy, and histories of music education, as well as a secondary general music education methods course. And I advised some dissertation writers. I am on dissertation committees, and I read qualifying examinations.
And for giving back, the things you do from the heart, you're involved in what and where?
Yes, my heart work is, and also my artwork, are performed in an orphanage in central Ho Chi Minh City near the Tansuna Airport. And it is an orphanage of about 250 children. And I work with the terminally ill children and their caregivers by making music with and for them. So many of these children will never leave their cribs, which look so much like cages. And they are not, we have free-range chickens here. These children are not free-range. They are caged. And they are silent. So many of them do not have power of voice. And so the music that I make with and for them is perhaps a way for them for me to make music for those who cannot make music, or for those who cannot or will not make music.
How do you integrate your life experience and the story, the extraordinary story that you just shared with our listeners, and how do you integrate that into your work?
When I first started teaching in fall of 1997, I came out of my undergraduate program like so many young music educators and teachers, saying, I'm going to conquer the world and I'm going to teach music. And that's not the real story. And I learned from my colleagues, both here in the States and abroad, that we don't teach music. We teach people. And music is one of the ways that we teach people. And my experiences with orphans in both Romania and in Vietnam has shown me that life is precious, that there is more to living than a concert adjudication or a marching band competition or a show choir competition or even teaching quarter notes and half notes. Those are, for me, conduit to youth development, to human development.
What's next for you? You're a young man, relatively young, 40 years old, and it seems like you're living a dream right now. Do you continue the dream, or are there still things on the checklist?
I don't know what's next. I'm still nearsighted, and my investments manager always gets on me about this. I say I've got 30 more years, so don't worry about it,
yeah.
Brian. And I don't know what's next. I feel like I need to live in Vietnam for a little bit.
Really?
Simultaneously, I want to get an assistant professor tenure track job. But I also want to work with youth. So I don't know what's next. Maybe I'm flying by the seat of my pants, and I feel like I'm a little old for that. But
going back to explore your heritage and your roots, the trail seems to have ended at the orphanage. Are you satisfied with that outcome?
Yes, I mean it's part of knowing who I am. It's a part of me. It's not all of me. I wish I knew more.
Is there a desire to have contact with DNA relatives, I mean actual biological relatives.
It would be fascinating to reconnect with biological relatives, and at the same time, there's so much scandal around connecting with Vietnamese families because anyone will claim that I am his or her child for the financial benefit.
Sure. So, living a dream. Do you feel like you're living a dream?
I think so. I'm well traveled. I took a year off between my PhD and working at Boston University and traveled about 160,000 air miles, visited five continents, and a lot of people would say, that's a dream. I say, it's my life. That's just what I do.
Yeah.
And it's hard to not have a central location because I feel like a vagabond in so many ways, a happy wanderer. and at the same time, it's definitely deepened who I am by seeing other places and going places and meeting people from around the world.
I don't mean to sound maudlin. You're only 40 years old. You got a few good years left in there, Vu. But regarding the people you've touched, and obviously there's so many people over the years, students and contacts that you've made, sharing your story, sharing your knowledge. How do you want to be remembered?
That's a story
or
that...
Or your life. How do you want your life to be remembered?
Eric Erickson, the developmental psychologist, would say that is stage 8 thinking. I think I'm in stage 6.
Yeah, right.
So this is a little advanced, Gary.
I know.
I guess I want to be remembered for having touched lives in meaningful ways through art, through making some kind of difference in lives of young people. Both in schools and out of schools, I want people to say that I was a cheerful soul who made some kind of contribution through art to the greater well-being of mankind and womankind.
Okay. We're out of time here today, Vu. I cannot thank you enough. I have been so excited about this interview, and I'm so thankful for you coming here and sharing that story.
Well, thank you, Gary.
I wish you big success. I love you. And thanks for being here today.
Yeah, cheers. Have a good one.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's 8:34, and we're going to break for news with Karenza next. WINY.